Hello, everyone. This is Pamela Brewer. Welcome to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, I talk to you about issues and events related to being a woman. And today's guest is going to help us explore the challenges to girls and parents living in a toxic culture. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Laura Hensley-Choate, who is Dr. Laura Hensley-Choate, is a professor of counselor education at Louisiana State University. Dr. Choate, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Well, you know, this is such an important conversation, as I think we all hear more and more about girls in school and girls out and about and what kinds of things are going on in some of the schools. It's pretty scary. You talk about a toxic culture for today's girls. What do you mean by a toxic culture?
Right. Yes, today's culture is directing negative, unrealistic pressures to girls about their worth and their value. And what I talk a lot about in the book is how these pressures can be harmful to girls' development and their mental health. And so I conceptualize these three pressures according to what I call the three A's. And the first has to do with their appearance, that there's pressure on girls today to be as hot and sexy as possible. And even at a very, very young age, this pressure has trickled down even to the preschool set. I also talk about the pressure on them to get as much attention as possible, both online and in real life, through their friendships, romantic relationships, and then certainly through social media, to be as famous as possible, to get as many followers as possible. And then the third A is they have pressure about having as many accomplishments as possible, to be perfect, to do it all, to make good grades, to do well in all their extracurriculars, and have lots of great friendships and have a boyfriend to boot. So there's a pressure on them to just to do it all. So that's the way I look at these toxic pressures according to appearance, attention, and accomplishments, and how that's just too much to expect any girl to be able to handle all at the same time.
Now, these kinds of pressures that you talk about, for anyone who's a woman, she knows about these kinds of pressures because she's been living with them for much of her life, mm-hmm. almost no matter what her age is. So how is it different? What is your particular concern? It's a concern that these exist, but what is your particular concern when it comes to girls?
Right. I think I totally agree with you that these pressures have existed for a long time for girls and women. But what is different today is, first, that these pressures are starting at younger and younger ages. So that if you look at the toys marketed to preschool girls, the clothes marketed to them, the media shows, they all encourage them to look hot and sexy at a really young age before young girls can even understand or begin to even comprehend what this means. I think so. That's a concern. The other concern is the social media. That's new. That's something that we didn't have to deal with when we were growing up. And it's that girls today feel like they constantly have to perform, that they are measured by their numbers. Their worth is measured by how many followers, how many likes do I get on my picture? I am just based on my numbers. And if my picture doesn't get a certain number of likes, then I'm not okay. It's not just about the picture, it's about me. So they have this tangible way of measuring their worth through their numbers that we just didn't have to deal with when we were growing up. That just, we dealt with the face-to-face relationships only. So that's new. And then the third thing that's new is that girls are reaching puberty at earlier and earlier ages today. So they look a lot older than they are. And that's such a concern because when we treat girls the way they look, they may look like a 16-year-old but really only be 10. And so developmentally, they're not prepared to handle the kind of pressures that a 16-year-old would face in terms of unwanted romantic attention, unwanted advances, people offering them, you know, alcohol, drugs, whatever it comes across when you hang out with an older crowd. So we girls today are faced with these pressures earlier because they look older than they really are.
You actually quote in your book, Swimming Upstream, Parenting Girls for Resilience in a Toxic Culture, you mention a Journal of Pediatric study that found mm-hmm. that some girls today have actually started to develop breasts at 7?
Yes. And that is even more common in African American girls than in Caucasian girls. But overall, just the age of breast development has dropped to 7, 8, 9 years old when you're starting to see breast development, and then all the other changes that occur with puberty. So when girls are starting to need a bra, but then the bras marketed to them are also padded so that their breasts look even larger than they even are, and they don't know how to handle the attention they get for having big breasts or looking sexually developed. That's a concern.
Or may not even understand why they have breasts. I mean, right. You know, depending on how young they are. And when you talk about today's young girls, you're really talking about young girls. You're talking about girls who are 5, 6, and 7 and up?
Yes. Really, the book is written for parents of the youngest girls from, you know, age, I guess, birth, all the way up through 18, because it's my belief that the earlier that we can intervene, the earlier that we can put these strategies for resilience into place, the better off girls are going to be. Because as we know, it's easier to prevent problems from occurring than to treat mental health problems once they become deeply entrenched. And that happens by the time a girl is in her early adulthood. So it's much better to start early and put these strategies in place at a very young age.
When you talk about the sexualization of girls, and you include mm-hmm. in it toys and clothing, and I'm going to throw in violent sexual games, what's the message that the broader culture is getting about sex, violence, and girls? What's the message that the broader older culture is getting about sex, violence, and girls?
Well, girls are being viewed as objects instead of as people. When a girl is put into a violent video game and she can just be killed along the way as if she were just an object, then boys are growing up, and girls play these games too, but boys are far more likely to play violent video games. They're learning that girls are expendable, they're objects, they're dehumanized in those kind of games. So whenever you link a hot and sexy girl and violence, that's the message that comes across. And that if girls are treated that way by the boys in their lives, by the people in their lives, then they may come to view themselves that way too and not value themselves for the people that they are, as objects.
You make reference to the sexualization of toys. What do you mean by that? How are toys sexual?
Well, if you look at what are the top-selling toys for little girls today, they are Bratz dolls and Monster High dolls, and Barbie is in third place today. It's Monster High and Bratz dolls are by far surpassing Barbie sales. And these dolls are sexualized. They're highly sexualized. They wear sexualized fashions, feather boas, high heels, stiletto high heels, the fishnet stockings, tight mini skirts, lots and lots of makeup. And so they look like adult women, sexualized women, but they're marketed to 2 and 3 year old girls. So as girls play with these, they over time start to think that's how I should look and that's how I should act if I want to get attention and have fun like these dolls seem to be. And all the marketing, they're all partying and having fun and playing in hot tubs and doing all the things that adult women do, but yet they're marketed to young girls. That's a problem, because when Barbie first was introduced in the 1950s, she was marketed to 10 to 12-year-old girls. Now that same Barbie is marketed to 2 and 3-year-old girls. We can't even imagine 12-year-olds playing with a Barbie today. But yet that just shows you how much our culture has changed. Well, because kids are growing up so much faster.
You know, when you talk about Barbie and the other dolls being marketed to 2 and 3 year olds, and then you know, you think about some of the clothes that are available even for 2 and 3 year olds, mm-hmm. it's kind of a challenge not to swallow real hard.
Right. And so for parents, we have to look at that and say, is that really what I want for my daughter? Just because this is, you go in every store and those are the clothes that I see. I go in down the aisle at Walmart or Target and these are the toys I see. Is that really what I want for my daughter? Just because it's popular, I can still say no, and I can still choose to do something differently. And that's part of what I try to emphasize in the book, is not telling people what to do per se, but to help parents question, just because this is the culture today, just because this is what's mainstream, I don't have to follow it. I can do something different. So does this make sense for me? Is this the value I want to pass along to my daughter?
Well, one of the things that I noticed very early on in your book, as you talk about resilient strategies, is you remind parents that it's okay to say no. And, you know, on the one hand, I sort of chuckled at that. But it is true that it is okay to say no. And so many parents, whether they're trying to be their daughter's friends or whether they're trying instead of their parent or whether they're trying to be cool or whatever they're doing, saying no is really hard for some parents to say.
Right. I hear this all the time just in my daily life as a parent. I hear so many parents saying, well, what are you going to do? All their friends are doing it. They're begging me. What are you going to do? And there's part of that too. It's difficult. It's not easy, and I totally empathize with that. But the flip side is there are things that we can do, and we can make decisions to. That's why I call the book Swimming Upstream. It feels like that sometimes, to swim upstream and do things differently. And part of that is going to be, sometimes you're going to be an unpopular parent. And that's hard. That's where, as parents, we have to ask ourselves, if we were people that were always concerned about being popular and fitting into the popular group and pleasing other people, we're going to have a harder time when we have to choose to say no to our daughters and maybe unpopular with them and maybe even be unpopular with other parents who are doing things differently than we're choosing to do. And that takes some strength. That takes parenting, what I say in the book, it's parenting from your inner core and deciding, these are my values, and I'm going to parent from those values, and not just because everybody else is doing it.
And that is harder to do, but it's more thoughtful way, I would suggest, to approach parenting. Another thing under your resilient strategy, you say that you should keep the TV out of your daughter's room. Wow.
Yes.
As I read that and I thought about that, and I just sort of imagined all these little girls having a collective pass out, you know, with parents saying, no, you can't have a TV in your room, which is almost now standard fare. You have a bed, you have a TV. That's kind of what you have in your room.
And that, again, is I leave that to parents to make that decision. But in the book, I talk about the American Academy of Pediatrics makes that recommendation to keep TVs out of kids' bedrooms. And they cite a lot of research that shows that a TV in a kid's bedroom is associated with a whole host of negative psychological and behavioral outcomes. So like the kids with TVs compared to kids without TVs in their rooms don't do as well in school. They don't get as much sleep. They start having sex at an earlier age. They start drinking at an earlier age. And of course, one thing doesn't cause the other. It's not like the TV in there magically causes these behaviors. But what it means is, if you have a TV in your room, you're more likely to watch more TV. And when you watch more TV, you're more likely to start to internalize what you're seeing on TV, which is mostly early sexual behaviors, all the different pressures that I've talked about today. And when you internalize those, you're more likely to act on them at an earlier age. So parents can decide, you know, we'll keep our TV in a public area so I can keep track of what my kid is watching and know that they're not watching something late at night that I wouldn't want them to be watching.
You also say, and I know that there are parents who are going to be somewhat troubled or struggle with some of your strategies, but I also, one of the things that I found really important about your book was that you give a lot of research. So you're making it clear that these are not just strategies that you came up with yesterday because you had free time, that these are strategies right. that are well thought out, they are well researched and well documented, which I think for some parents is something that they will need, because for some of the folks reading this book, you're asking them to do things that I would suspect are very different from what they do now. For example, in addition to keeping the TV out of your child's room, you're also saying keeping computers and any internet-equipped device out of your daughter's room. That would include a cell phone, and we know lots of kids are sort of tethered to their cell phones.
Right. Now, that has become much more of a challenge. It's easier to say keep the TV out of there because that's one giant piece of equipment to move. The cell phone and really any other device, that's going to be harder because kids say, hey, we need that for homework. I need computers to do, you know, whatever I need to do. So at least during part of the day, parents can say, all right, there's going to be technology-free zones during our day. So during mealtime, put the devices away. At bedtime, give your devices to me. And that's the devices stay in a public area of the house, or the parent can even have them in their room. We know that kids don't do as well when they have their cell phones and laptops and devices in their room all night. And we hear lots of examples of where kids are texting all night or be on social media all night, and parents aren't aware of it, and then their grades start dropping, and it just leads to a downward cycle. So it is okay for a parent to say, no, at bedtime, the devices come with me. And I know that's hard. It might sound revolutionary, but that really is what's best for our kids.
And I noticed that you're using the word bedtime, which sounds to me like you are suggesting or assuming that there is a specific bedtime, that there is a specific structure that would need to be adhered to.
Yes, that's what's recommended as well. And as we know, when kids don't get enough sleep, it has a definite downward spiral of negative consequences if they're not getting adequate sleep at night, especially as they reach adolescence, when they naturally want to stay up later, their bodies are wired to stay up later, but still they're required to get up early to go to school. So parents may need to intervene even more in the adolescent years, because my kids now are 10 and 12. They conk out. They're ready to go to bed. It's not like it's easy, but it's not too hard to get them to go to bed and fall asleep. Whereas for an older adolescent, that's going to be a struggle because their bodies are wired to stay up maybe till midnight. But we know that if they need 8 to 9 hours of sleep a night, they have to get up at, you know, whatever time in the morning to go to school, it's still important for them to have a structured bedtime and a routine leading up to that bedtime, which would include no technology, because technology keeps you awake. It doesn't help you fall asleep.
You know, at the risk of repeating a lot of what you've just said and a lot of what we've just talked about, I think it's so important to really underscore these strategies that you're identifying, which, again, I know for many parents may seem like an impossible task, but clearly what you're saying, and you have the research to support it, is that when you are allowing your child to sort of go off into their own electronic world and stay there, you are allowing your child to be exposed to harm, and for many parents in ways that they don't even realize. I mean, I think about all these websites and all these apps that, you know, we're hearing about every single day that are targeting children, and a lot of parents don't really know that they even exist.
Right. And it's sort of like you would never just drop your kid off at midnight on a, you know, busy street corner where there's, you know, lots of traffic and shops and everything going on, and just leave them there at midnight. But yet that's essentially what we're doing when we leave them alone in their bedrooms at night with their devices. They have the world at their fingertips, both for good and for bad. And we as parents can be more attentive to that and say, okay, I want to know what my child is doing when they're online. And if I keep the devices in a public place in the home, and especially if I know they don't have their devices at night when I'm not around, then that's one way of protecting my child.
So don't drop, you're not going to drop your child off at midnight in a bunch, around a bunch of strangers in reality, so don't do it in your home. I think that's a wonderful right. way to think about it. Dr. Choate, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to explain what the Bechdel test is and how parents can benefit from actually utilizing that. So we're going to take a break, okay. and we'll be right back. Folks, swimming sure. upstream, parenting girls for resilience in a toxic culture. And I am speaking with the author, Dr. Laura Choate. Exactly what is the Bechdel test?
Yes, it's interesting. The next time you watch a movie with your family or just even on your own, it's interesting to see if the movie can pass this test where you ask yourself three questions. One, does the movie have at least two named women characters? A lot of times there might be one, but does it have two women characters that you could actually name that are, you know, have names? And that means they're central into the plot. And then second, does the women contain at least two women who talk to each other? Does it show a female friendship in the movie? And then in the movie, do the women talk to each other about something besides a man? And so if you could answer all three of those questions, it said that it could pass this test. And it's interesting when you start paying attention that when there are female characters in movies, they're often secondary to whatever the main action is. And then even if they are the main character, do they have friendships with other women that are supportive and positive? And do they talk about something besides being in a relationship with a man?
You know, it's a short little test, but it's really powerful when you apply it to mm-hmm. the kinds of things that you're looking at. Did you determine that there were any films or television programs that did not pass this test?
Yes, if you go to, and this isn't my test, by the way, I retrieved it from the BanBossy.com website, which is a very, very great organization. Sheryl Sandberg and other powerful women leaders have really spoken out recently about how negative it is for girls when they speak up or when they're assertive or when they're in leadership positions to call them bossy, and that therefore the term ban bossy. And it has got so, the website has so many wonderful resources for parents and even for educators and for girls themselves about learning how to become leaders and that it's okay to speak up and say what you think and not always be afraid that you'll be labeled negatively and labeled bossy. So if you go to the website, it actually has a list of the movies that did pass the test and movies that didn't. It's a compiled on a yearly basis.
And that website
is really, banbossy.com.
All right, so that's BanBossy.com.
Right.
Okay. So when you are expressing concerns about what the children are learning, and certainly what young girls in particular are learning, one of the things that you've expressed a concern about is the development of empathy and healthy social skills. What is the importance of empathy in terms of a child's development?
Right. So for people who aren't as familiar with that term, I know we all kind of, we toss it around a lot, but empathy really means that you can imagine what it feels like to be another person and then express that you understand that to that other person. So if you have empathy, it means almost that you're crawling inside the other person's skin or you imagine what it feels like to walk in their shoes. And what happens today with so much of kids' friendship occurring online and through social media and through texting, they don't have the face-to-face interactions that so that they don't learn the social skills needed to be able to read the subtle social cues. So if I said something to you that hurt your feelings, I could see it on your face. I would read it in your body language, and I would learn, okay, I shouldn't say things like that to people again. But when all of this socialization is occurring through texting or online, you don't see how your words impact the other person. If you don't see how the other person might be hurt by your quick text that you fire off, or the little statement you might make on a post you might make on Instagram. So kids today aren't learning that basic social skills needed for face-to-face interaction and for good communication, and certainly they aren't learning the skills needed for empathy, to grow up to really learn how my words, my actions might be hurting somebody else, and that I don't want to do that. And it's so much easier when the kids today say it's so much easier to send a text or to just do something online rather than have to deal with people face to face. They say that's just too messy, it's too complicated to have a face to face conversation. So the whole conversational skills that most kids learn in childhood and adolescence, that's a lot of that's being lost today.
So it sounds like it's even more important for parents not only to employ some of the limits that we've already talked about in terms of the child's exposure to the world of technology, but also to be very careful about what parents themselves are saying and doing and watching. That the children are watching what the parents are doing, and it almost sounds like it's even more important than it was in days past that parents emulate the kinds of things they want children to learn.
Right. If a child learns many of their social skills through their initial interactions with their parents, they learn how to do that first before they go on and do it with friends and then later in romantic relationships. If the parent is always on their phone, if the parent is never giving their child their full attention because they're responding to the ping from their phone, the text is pulling them away, the email is pulling them away, then how is the child going to learn that? And how do we ask our children to take breaks from social media, from their phones, when we're not doing the same? So, yes, modeling times during the day where we give our children our 100% attention. And that's easier said than done. If you look around in our culture today, most people are, if you go to a restaurant, most of the people sitting there are in their phone, lost in their phones, and they're not interacting with one another. So parents do need to be mindful of modeling good social skills in terms of their own media use, but also good social skills in terms of especially for women, how do we talk about other women in front of our daughters? How do we, are we always cutting them down? Are we gossiping about them behind their backs? Or do we have positive female friendships of our own? Because we know if girls watch TV, what are they going to see? Women fighting each other, cat fights, on reality TV shows, they're backbiting, backstabbing. I mean, it's all very, very negative what they see about girls' friendships on TV, especially through reality television programs. So how are moms modeling positive female friendships? Because that's what we want our daughters to have, is to learn to look at other girls as allies and not as just competitors.
You know, as I think about even some of the movies that are available on television, or even the, you know, the regular, the sitcoms or the whatever that's mm-hmm. on television, and I think about the girls and how the girls talk to each other, there's a lot of name calling very often. There's a lot of shaming. And it's not that they're using bad language, but, oh, you're a dummy, or don't be so silly. I mean, these kinds of words are actually powerful and matter. And not only do we prefer that a child not be exposed to them in their media, but certainly not at home, which is what you're saying. And the notion that girls are often taught to dislike other girls, that's such a sad lesson that mm-hmm. girls and women have learned over time.
Right. I have worked with many girls I've done workshops with them over the years, and they talk about how they just say friendships with other girls are so complicated, they're so messy. I just a lot of them have given up and they're just friends with boys because they say it's just harder for them. And that's partly driven by these media messages that we're hearing, and partly what they're learning from looking at adult women in their lives. And then that's not what we want, because girls do best when they have positive friendships and positive female supporters around, both through adult women and through girls their age. And so we should try to encourage that, to encourage healthy friendships and relationships and not the toxic ones that we often see in the media.
When you talk about, and I'm going back to your resilience strategies, one of mm-hmm. the things that you recommend is that parents, in working with their children, focus on the different, teaching their children the difference between reality and perception. Boy, that's a lesson I think we could all stand to learn routinely. But you also want a child to work, you want a parent to work with her child on normalizing her experience. Put that in a context for those parents who are listening and they're not quite sure what that actually looks like in their day-to-day interaction with their daughters.
Okay, I think, are you talking about in terms of her friendship with other girls?
In terms of her friendships with other girls and in terms of how she sees herself physically.
Okay, yes, because I think that's two different things. That when she is reaching the years of puberty, which for some girls that can be much earlier than you expect, it's so helpful for her to know that what's happening to her body is a normal experience that happens to every girl. It may happen at different times for different girls, but it happens to every girl, and that she's going to gain weight in her hips and thighs, her breasts are going to develop, that she needs to understand the whole process of the developmental process of reaching puberty. And when she's educated and knows that that's normal and it's not something that's making her different or freaky from other people, that can help a lot to just be prepared. I guess that's during these developmental years. And I think we can't start early enough in preparing girls just with basic education about what is going to happen to their bodies, because we don't know. For some girls, it does happen much earlier than we expect.
We also want to talk to our children, our daughters and our sons, about the kinds of friends they're choosing, but that's a mm-hmm. hard conversation to have. How would you recommend parents go about that?
Right. I always recommend that she look at what are the qualities she's looking for in a friend, and to list those, you know, top two or three qualities, and then to look at her current group of friends, and do they have those same qualities? And if they don't, what is it that's attracting her to those friendships? What's drawing her in? And friendships, helping her understand that friendships should be based on being around people that help you feel good about yourself, that you feel better about yourself after having been around them, and not worse. That so many friendships today can be so toxic for girls that they come away from them feeling bad, questioning themselves, questioning their reality. Does she really like me? Does she not like me? She was friends with me yesterday, but she's not friends with me today. So learning to not trust their own perceptions. So we need for girls to back up, and parents can help them do this, to step back for a minute and say, is this really a friendship? If it's somebody that causes me to question myself, feel badly about myself, is a girl able to stand up for herself and say what she thinks and disagree with the friend and still remain in the friendship? Or does the friend threaten to leave her or get mad at her? So if she can't answer those basic questions about, you know, really the qualities of a healthy relationship, then help her start to question, you know, what is it that you're getting out of the friendship, and why is it that you're staying in this particular friendship? Now, I know it's really hard for a girl to pull out of a friendship or say this isn't healthy for me, but anything that parents can do to help her start to just plant those seeds of questioning, and maybe helping her develop friendships in other areas outside of school, having her be involved in activities that are away from just school, can be helpful too. Because what we don't want girls to learn is oh, I should have to tolerate people treating me badly. I should just go back again and again and again, even when people treat me badly, just so I can hold on to a friendship. Because then that will translate when she's older and involved in romantic relationships into even more dysfunctional patterns, where she'll stay in a romantic relationship even though the person's treating her badly, even though it makes her feel badly about herself, just so she can say she has that romantic relationship. So really developing those skills in girlhood and with friendships sets the stage for how she's going to handle healthy romantic relationships when she gets older.
And, you know, it sounds like a question that parents can actually ask themselves as well. You know, what am I modeling for my child? Who are my friends? What are my friends bringing to the table? Is this working for me? Once you've had these hard conversations with your child, can you just forget about it? You just have it once, and then can you be done and go do something else?
Well, I think you maybe have the first conversation where you open the door, and then that door stays open. So hopefully she'll feel more comfortable in being able to come to you and talk to you about these issues in the future. And that's what we want. We want to be an askable parent. We want to be a parent that our children can feel comfortable coming to us and asking us about, is this, you know, this friendship is, you know, my friend isn't talking to me today. What can I do? Or, you know, later on, these people want me to go to a party. I'm not sure about it. We want that door to stay open. So no, I wouldn't say it's just a one-time thing where we can just forget about it. I view it more as opening the door, or to use another analogy, we're planting seeds along the way, and we never know when those seeds are going to develop into fruit, but at least we will have planted the seeds. And that's what's important.
It sounds like you're saying parenting is an ongoing process. No shortcuts.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, yes.
You want parents to teach their children self-awareness. So many girls in particular, as we've said earlier, spend so much time looking at themselves and primping and hoping that they look good enough for what. When you say self-awareness, you're not talking about what it is you look like. What are you talking about? What do you want parents to teach their children?
Yes, there's a big difference between looking good for other people and knowing who you are. And that takes and what I call it in the book is developing an authentic sense of self, that knowing who you are, what you believe and what you value, that you're then able to stand up and say and stand by your beliefs and values without trampling on the rights of other people. So you can be strong in yourself and know, this is who I am. I'm not going to compromise who I really am. But yet I can get along well with other people. I know how to compromise. I have empathy. I have good social skills too, because we want our daughters to be kind people. We just don't want our daughters to be overly concerned with pleasing others at all costs so that she loses her own sense of self. So learning to be self-aware means having the time for reflection to discover, who am I? What do I believe? What do I value? What are my strengths? What are things that I want to do with my future? What are my goals? Just being able to take the time to really know who you are. So many girls don't take the time to do that today because they're constantly online, on social media. So they're performing for other people to please other people online. And if they're not doing that, then they're rushing around from activity to activity to activity. And they never have time to just stop and think, what is this all for? Who am I? Where am I going? Why is this important to me?
So again, in terms of a resilience strategy for a parent, it's also really paying attention. And as you said, listening well, listening continually, and being an askable parent. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, you talk about safe thrills, which doesn't sound like that's possible. So I'm going to want to know, what are safe thrills and what is scaffolding, which is something you ask parents to practice. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Dr. Choate, help me understand safe thrills and how it is that you recommend to parents as part of resilience strategies that they allow their daughters to seek safe thrills.
Okay. I talk about this issue in the chapter on girls' development. So in the book, I first talk about the cultural context that girls are facing today, and then I go into their internal changes that are occurring as they move from girlhood into adolescence. And part of that is, in as they move through puberty, their limbic system, the part of their brains that really fire up their emotions and their risk-taking, this is what we see in all teenagers, is where they drive too fast, they do everything too fast, they take too many risks. That's all firing up in her brain. And the part of the brain, her prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that helps to regulate that and say, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Maybe I need to consider the consequences here. That part of her brain develops much more slowly than the risk-taking part of the brain. And this is even worse for boys, as we know. But for girls, as they're trying to learn how to use that part of their brain that helps them stop and think and regulate and weigh the risks and weigh the consequences, we can't just let her go and say, okay, good luck with that. What parents have to do is to help her explore that risk-taking side of her brain in safe ways. So what are ways that she can get a thrill that really are still going to be safe, where she's not going to be harmed in some way? And what I talk about in the book are just simple things like, could she go zip lining? Could she go rock wall climbing? Could she ride a roller coaster? Could it be something where she gets that thrill-seeking experience, but in a safe way? And you mentioned earlier about scaffolding. That's kind of what that is all about. We need to allow our children to take slow risks in safe context, and then gradually take that scaffolding away as they become more mature. So it might be first you let your child go to a birthday party alone, but you stay outside in your car. But then, you know, when they handle that for a while, a year later, you would take them to the birthday party and then you leave, but you make sure the person has the phone. And then it might be a year later that you can allow them to go to a boy-girl party as long as they're chaperoned. It just means that you take away the scaffolding, the structure, the support that you've put in place very slowly as the child learns to develop additional responsibility and the ability to self-regulate and question whether this is safe or not safe, and is this good for me or not good for me.
And I do want to come back to your saying do this very slowly, because I hear you talking about making changes a year at a time. And for many parents, if they've taken their daughter, for example, to a party, and let's say they sat outside to make sure that everything was okay, and they've done that for a couple of parties, they're figuring the daughter's fine now. But you're saying a year right. later and a year later.
No, I was just giving that as an example. I think that's where you go by case. Each parent knows their child best. It may not need to be a year. For some kids, it may need to be a year. But for some daughters, if she's shown good sense and good responsibility, then that might be okay. I think it's just I was using the year just to make a point. I think every parent just needs to take the time to evaluate that. Could they handle that level of responsibility okay? And if so, all right, can I go to the next level? And so you do it methodically and slowly rather than just ripping the whole support system away all at once.
You also talk about parents allowing consequences to unfold and to give your daughter problem-solving opportunities. Mm-hmm. Talk about the importance of these two things in particular. And I say that recognizing that there are so many parents who try so hard to keep their children from having to suffer the consequences of their behavior, seeing that as part of good parenting. You're saying let the consequences unfold. Give your child a problem-solving opportunities.
Right, because we have to think about what is our ultimate goal as a parent, and that's to raise a child who can be a successful adult, who can solve their own problems, take care of themselves, cope with life stressors as they arise. That's our eventual goal. We're raising them in order to be able to do those things for themselves. So we're hopefully none of us are planning on following our kids around the rest of their lives to try to help them have a problem-free life. We want them to recognize, yes, there are going to be problems in life, and I have the skills and ability to handle problems when they come at me. That's what gives kids confidence. That's what gives kids competence in facing life challenges. So just little things along the way give kids a message, I know you have what it takes to figure this out. So if your child comes home and says, this is the classic example of, I don't have, it's 10 o'clock at night and I haven't done my project and I need a poster board or glue or whatever it might be, that we don't always just bail the kid out at the last minute. You might want to do that one time, but if that becomes a pattern, then is that really helping your child? What are they really learning from that? This happened with my daughter recently. She forgot her band instrument at school, and they get in trouble if they forget their band instrument. Do I see her flute on the couch and go, oh no, she forgot her flute again, and jump in my car and rush to the school to deliver it to her? Or do I allow her to have the consequence, which is a bad grade, because she forgot her flute? So that in the hopes next time she will be responsible enough to make sure she has her flute by the front door so she takes it with her when it's time to go to school. That's what I want for her. Yes, I hate that she had to suffer and get a bad grade and was embarrassed because she forgot her flute, but I also want the long-term result of having my daughter learn that I can be responsible for myself. I have what it takes to be responsible and problem solve and cope with challenges of life. She's not going to get that if I run chase after her with the flute every time.
So, again, trying to micromanage your child's life, not good for your child, not good for the parent.
Right. For one thing, it's exhausting for the parent. And for the other thing, it sends the child the message. And I have to, as a parent, I remind myself of this frequently, as it's actually disempowering for our children when we constantly do everything for them because they think, oh, my parent doesn't think I have what it takes to do this. They don't think that I'm good enough or I'm smart enough or competent enough to do this on my own. They think they have to do it for me. So I must not be very competent. I must not be very independent or must not have what it takes because my parent is constantly rescuing me and doing it for me. And that's the last message we want to be sending to our kids.
Absolutely. Dr. Cho, we've been talking about girls, and indeed the mm-hmm. name of your book is Parenting Girls, the subtitle, Parenting Girls for Resilience in a Toxic Culture. What does that mean about boys? Are they not important? Yeah, are they not exposed?
Right. It's so interesting. I've done several radio interviews now, and every single time somebody has asked me about the boys. And I think that that's a very valid point. I'm not saying at all that boys aren't important or that there aren't cultural pressures on today's boys that are very harmful to them as well. It's just that in this particular book, my area of expertise is girls and women's mental health. And so I focused on girls in this book. I think that certainly another book is needed that focuses on what are the cultural pressures on today's boys and how can parents parent their sons for resilience in this toxic culture where boys have to live up to different kinds of cultural expectations. But it's just not my focus in this book.
And just to let folks know that you do actually mention male entities, you make the point that fathers actually do matter. And you actually quote research that says that girls who have healthy exposure to their dads actually are seen to do better in many areas.
Yes, it's so interesting. The studies that show that girls have supportive and close relationships with their dads do better in school. They have higher levels of positive body image. They have greater self-confidence and they do better in just in the workplace and in just life in general. They tend to thrive when they know they have the support and love and validation of their dads. They play a critical role in girls' development and mental health.
All right, so three cheers for dads.
Yes, by all means.
The idea that one's child, in this case one's daughter, might be having a mental health issue. For many parents, the thought is, she's just a kid, she should have my problems, she can't possibly have an issue. Whereas for other parents, it's, you know, oh no, not my daughter, she's perfectly fine. I mean, there are so many ways that parents find to either be frightened of their daughter's mental health or to decide that they don't really have an issue. What do you say to parents when they're looking at the mental health of their daughters?
Yes. I have an entire chapter in my book about different mental health issues that are common in today's girls and that seem to be on the rise in today's girls. So I think part of it is, it would be helpful if they read that chapter in my book and to read the whole book, but to be aware of that there are certain issues that tend to emerge as girls reach puberty and adolescent years, that they tend to be, they're skyrocketing today, especially when you compare the levels in girls compared to boys. And those issues are depression, anxiety, eating disorders, self-injury, substance abuse, and sexual victimization. That might be dating violence or actual sexual trauma or rape. And those are all scary words. They're scary terms. They're things parents don't want to think about. But knowledge is key, and early intervention is key. So if they're aware of, these are the signs and symptoms, these are the early warning signs that I'm seeing in my daughter, and having that knowledge and information and preparation is so helpful so they can get help early rather than later. Because later, once these problems have become entrenched in their daughter's lives, it's much harder to treat than when you catch them early and can do some things early on to help her get back to her regular level of functioning.
The wisdom then is, pay attention to your child and don't close your eye to something just because you don't understand it or don't want it to be true.
Right, right. By the age of 15, the current statistics show that about at least 15% of girls have already had an episode of major depressive disorder. That I think it's so interesting to look at, between the ages of 12 and 15, the rates of depression triple in girls. That tends to be the age which is typically when they're really entering puberty and going through all those changes, plus all the changes and pressures they're receiving from school and from culture, that levels of depression triple in that time period, and they hardly change at all for boys during that time.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, that's just something parents need to be aware of and to know that, oh, depression isn't something that just happens to people or to adults. It happens in young girls as well.
And again, you're saying that between the ages of 12 and 15, incidents actually rise.
Right. They triple. I mean, girls between the ages of 12 and 15.
That's pretty extraordinary. Now, as I said, you've written this book, Swimming Upstream. You're giving parents lots of resilience strategies. You've got lots of research. Kind of sounds like parenting is work.
Huh. Yes, I guess that is what I'm saying, but it's meaningful work. And it's so much more effective. I think the point I'm trying to make is, if we know what's going on in the culture and we take the time to decide, is this what I want for my daughter? Am I going to have to do some things differently? And if they're armed with strategies for resilience, which sometimes can be simple things like, let's just not watch TV right now, or get off your phone right now and let's have a conversation, or let's go for a walk outside. So I don't think it has to be cumbersome necessarily, but it's about the awareness, and then the skills that you need. And many of these things will come naturally to parents. They just need to be intentional in what they're doing. And just to be clear, so it's clear what I mean by all the strategies of resilience, I have a chapter just devoted to how parents can build positive body image in their daughters, I have another chapter on how parents can help their daughters develop healthy friendships and romantic relationships. So healthy relationships, and then a chapter on helping their daughters have good balance in their academics, keeping their academics in perspective and not be running around and constantly pressured and hurried throughout their childhood and adolescent years. And then the final chapter is on cultivating strong coping skills and problem-solving strategies that they can use really in handling all the problems that they'll face in their lives. So when I say resilience, that's part of what I mean in building the different strategies. It is partly on being aware. It is partly on making good choices in terms of your own values. But then it's also about building the skills in those five different areas that I just named.
And clearly you are saying, you know, here's a list of things for you to consider, but you're also doing that all important part, which is, and here's how to approach these things. You know, so many times people will give guidance and they'll say, all right, I want you to go through steps 1 through 5, and you're still on step 1 trying to figure out how to make that one actually happen. So I appreciate the detail and the time that you put into actually walking parents through how to engage in these strategies and what they actually look like. I think at the end of the book, parents are much better informed, if nothing else, but how to parent from their core values, which is so important for parents and for their children.
Right. That's what I hope that people take away is, yes, I need to be have knowledge of what's going on in the culture, knowledge of my daughter's development and her potential mental health problems. But also, I can make choices to make a difference. I don't have to just throw up my hands and say, oh, well, this is just the way things are, that I can make an active decision to swim upstream, to do things differently for my daughter. And then in the book, I provide strategies to help them know how to do that, sure, how to help their daughter swim upstream.
Dr. Choate, is there a website for the book?
The book is available on Amazon and through major booksellers. I have a website, which is Dr. Laura Choate at WordPress.com. Also, I can be found on Facebook and Twitter at Dr. Laura Choate.
All right. So there are ways that people can follow the work that you're doing, which is so important. Dr. Choate.
Certainly. I forgot about this one, on Psychology Today. I have a blog under the Parenting Expert. So if you go to Girls and Women's Wellness, I have a blog on Psychology Today.
Wonderful. So lots of places where people can continue to be guided by your expertise. Thank you so much, Dr. Laura Choate, author of Swimming Upstream, Parenting Girls for Resilience in a Toxic Culture. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
And folks, thank you for listening to us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. For more information about Mind Talk, remember you can go to mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. You can also go to mindtalk.org and leave comments or send an email. And folks, I hope that you will continue to join me and to join us here at Mind Talk. And remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.